I'm pleased to be able to talk a little bit about the returning service members, but we have several returning service members and veterans in the audience and also on our panel, and so they can give more firsthand accounts. I'm a psychiatrist. I work at both the university and the VA, and I've been a psychiatrist at the VA for over 24 to almost 25 years. So I have experience from that end, although I have never actually served myself. So hopefully the other folks will step up and help us when there are gaps in my knowledge. Particularly Nick and Ed. So I was wondering what would bring people out here tonight, particularly when I looked at the weather forecast. And so I thought I would just start off trying to get to know a little bit about you and why you came tonight. And I know that these are not, these people might have multiple reasons. And actually looking at this group here, I think I could have added another, but we'll hear from you guys why you're here. So how many people here are service members? Okay, so this is gonna be my go-to corner here. Family members of service members. Okay, some more. How many of you are thinking that you might provide services to service members or do provide services? Okay. How many just want to help veterans in the community? Okay, so a pretty universal reason for coming here tonight. And then how many are here for course credit? What courses are you taking that they're going to give you credit for this? I'm sorry? Oh, okay. So are you medical students, nursing students? Nursing students, well, welcome. It's great to have nurses being trained in these areas. And you have some illustrious faculty who have served, actually. So I hope you get to know them during the course of education. Okay, the first point I wanted to make for people is these are really long wars. And let me see, the gentleman in yellow sweater, how old were you when you, in September 11th, 2001? You were seven, yeah. And so many of our service members were not that much older when they were serving or when the towers first went down. We invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, shortly thereafter. And now in 2014, we're drawing down our troops. We're going to be down to 9,800 in 2015, half of that in 2016, and then we should be out in 2017. That's a 16-year long war. That's pretty remarkable. The Iraq invasion occurred in 2003, and we took out our last combat brigade troop in 2010, but we're upping the number of advisors, so we'll have 3,000 troops back in the country. And that's if things with ISIS do not get worse. And maybe Nick can tell us something about that later. So the first point is just, I want to make is the length of these wars. They have gone on and on and on. The next point I want to make is that the percentage of people who've actually served in these wars of the U.S. population is very small. A lot of people, over 2.6 million people, but only about 2% of the population, U.S. population, between 18 and 44, the age group that would generally serve. So long war, small percentage of our population. And so that means that people have deployed several times often. In our own work with the Michigan National Guard, we have worked with people who have come home. We've worked with them for a year, and in another year, they're preparing to go back. And in 2 years, they're back again in theater. Who knows what the National Guard is? Okay. Who doesn't know what the National Guard is? Be honest. It's okay. Okay, thank you, brave people, brave Nordic people. So the National Guard is our civilian soldiers, and they generally do not work for the federal government most of the time. They work for the state, and the governor is their, what would you call the commander-in-chief. They train a weekend a month and 2 weeks in the summer, and then they pick up training if they're deployed. Usually, they have not until these wars been deployed in large numbers, but these wars have brought these folks into the battlefield. And about 35 to 40% of our troops during very difficult periods of the war were National Guard soldiers. National Guard soldiers were often thought that they would be in supportive positions. However, bringing food supplies to the active component, the full-time professional soldiers. But actually, in these wars, the front lines were not so clear. So people who were providing supplies were often in danger because of the improvised explosive devices and the firefights that would occur along the road as they supplied the troops. They also face unique challenges when they get back. Professional soldiers go back to bases. National Guard soldiers go back to their communities very soon after deployment. Nick, that would sometime be in a week or so after coming back.
Sometimes
as short a period as 4 days. So you're in battle, and then you're back in Muskegon, maybe back in the hometowns of some of the University of Michigan students here. Do any of you know National Guard soldiers from your home community? Yeah. So, okay. And when they go back, they have a period of time when they still have some benefits and some income coming in, but then they really need to rejoin the civilian workforce. So 4 days later, a week later, they're back in their home community, not with any kind of military-trained mental health professionals, often not with the people they deployed with. They're on leave for a while, and their job may or may not be there for them. There are less resources available as well as far as treatment facilities. So these are the first slide on the mental health needs. And what you can see is they screen soldiers as they come back. This is really kind of a new thing to do. For those of us who were of age during the Vietnam era war, we became more aware of the mental health casualties during that war, but there was no systematic way of following people after they returned. This is actually the first war where we screened people before they went, and then we screened them when they came back, and we could actually quantify the kind of sequelae that come from deployments. And what you can see is that PTSD is fairly prevalent, but so is depression. Depression is often not recognized as a post-traumatic disorder, but it's actually equivalent in the prevalence among returning soldiers as PTSD. What you can also see here on this slide is the difference between the active component and the National Guard, perhaps because of the reasons that I outlined before, the unique aspects of the National Guard. What happens is that soldiers come back, or service members come back across all the branches. They're given a screen. They talk very briefly to a mental health professional, and the mental health professional decides with that screen whether they need to be have a further evaluation and makes recommendations to the service member. And about 18% of the active component are given a recommendation for further evaluation, but up to 40% of the National Guard by about 3 months. So this is a slide that just reminds us about the course of what happens to people when they come back. First of all, not everybody who has a trauma develops PTSD. And those who do develop PTSD-like symptoms will usually have reductions, particularly in the first year. So often commonly, when you have friends or family members or community members get back, they're going to have troubles with a number of things, particularly sleep. Sleep is a big common problem that often takes some time to rectify, but also some avoidance of maybe crowded situations or unpredictable situations, and irritability. Irritability is particularly hard on family members and community members and maybe fellow employees if you want to keep your job. There's substantial reductions in these symptoms in the first year, but about 15% will go on to have chronic PTSD and still be symptomatic at the end, and they could benefit from formal treatment. So what are the things that predict whether people are going to do well, whether the PTSD symptoms will fade, whether the depression will get better? Well, some of the things are higher unit support. So one of the things that they've done is looked at the quality of the leadership of these units. And those who rate their commanders as high, units that rate their commanders as high, their outcomes are much better, much less likely to develop PTSD. Also, the social support that people receive when they come home from deployments makes a large difference. This is going to be a point. I'm only going to make three points that I want folks to remember. Otherwise, you can pick up paper as you leave so that you remember. But the first point is, it's not only what happens to you in theater. It's not only the traumatic event that you can experience there, some which are very dramatic, but it's also the kind of reception you get when you came home. Is there social support? Is there a job? And so the social support afterward has been strongly linked to patients, to soldiers' outcomes, and hopefully perhaps preventing some of them from becoming patients. Job loss is huge. People without a job have much higher rates of PTSD at the end of the year. And if your coworkers seem to have suffered, perhaps letting you know that it was difficult for you when you went away, they also are more likely to develop PTSD. There are a lot of treatments for PTSD, and maybe some of you as nurses will be participating in those eventually. And evidence-based, and you'll be learning about that, means that people have undergone, these kind of treatments have undergone randomized trials, which are long, expensive, very difficult to do. So there are a million, just a plethora of treatments out there. People might have heard about therapeutic riding. There are also other kinds of alternative treatments, sort of outward bound things that soldiers will do. But the ones that have been most investigated are prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, and also some medications, antidepressants, sertraline and paroxetine. So prolonged exposure means that you are going to recount in a graduated way the trauma that you experienced repeatedly in a safe environment with gradually increasing exposure to that trauma, and often some additional exposure that you will do for yourself outside of the therapy sessions. It can be very difficult for people and sometimes hard for them to stick with treatment because it's associated with a discomfort, particularly at the beginning when people might be. So, ma'am, if you could hold your questions, what we're gonna do, so we're gonna take all sorts of questions at the end. And we can talk more about prolonged exposure at this point. And we have someone from our PCT team here, Ed, who will be really happy, I think, to talk a little bit more about this. Cognitive processing therapy is more aimed at thoughts that people might have. My soldiers wouldn't have had those casualties if I had done X, Y, and Z. I'm a bad person. I didn't get out of bed that morning when they were out doing whatever they were doing when a bad event happened, as well as some elements of exposure. I want to make a point about treatment. There are antidepressant treatments that are effective for PTSD, but many soldiers, because they experience anxiety, will, particularly if they're seeing providers that are not experienced in PTSD, will get anti-anxiety medications like Xanax, Ativan, and these are actually not helpful to them and not helpful to the core experience. Does everyone know what a Xanax is? Betavan, yeah. They're very popular. They reduce anxiety immediately. Over the long period of time, they can actually interfere with effective treatments. There's also some evidence-based treatments for depression that people can learn more about that are pretty common. So what can you do? For those of you who raised your hand and said, I really want to know how to help veterans, it's not just what happens to them in theater, it's what happens when they come home, okay? Provide support for veterans. If they're your coworkers, please welcome them back. Think about what jobs that you know about or that you can offer. Understand that they will have symptoms and accommodate those symptoms. If they're irritable for a while after they get back, try to accommodate that, but do expect improvement. If they're not improving after 4 months or so, this is really means that maybe they need to step up to formal treatment. And understand what some basic resources are. I think some of you raised your hand that you have family members who are service members. Not every service member is eager to go for help. So we'll talk a little bit about our Michigan programs. Not an unusual circumstance would be someone calling and saying, my son or daughter is in the basement, they're playing video games, they're not doing anything with their life, they're irritable, and they won't go for treatment. So how do you talk to someone when you think that the time for improvement has happened, but they're still pretty symptomatic, they're still irritable, they still can't engage in meaningful activities? Well, one thing to do is just to listen to them. They may or may not tell you what kind of experiences they have or what they're feeling. Another is to really let what they're saying sink in. Don't try to fix it right away, but reflect back what you've heard from them. Normalize treatment seeking. One of the things that people don't know is that there have been low rates in the military, but there have been a lot of efforts to change that. In Michigan, we've been working with the National Guard now for about 6 years, and now about 70% of people who report PTSD symptoms indicate that they're also going for some mental health evaluation or treatment. So when you say, you know, people with symptoms like this often go, that can be the case and is the case in certain communities. You might want to think if they're not listening to you, sometimes veterans will listen to other veterans. And we have peer programs where veterans who have been there will talk to your veteran. And then there's also an interesting service by the VA, which is kind of called Coach into Care. If you have a veteran who's not going for treatment, you can actually call this number and someone will talk to you about your veteran and talk with you, specifically shaping how you might approach them to move them closer to getting care. Here are some basic resources. I talked to Nick and Ed about this. We didn't want to overwhelm you. Out in the back, there are many, many more resources. But I just want you to remember a few. One is that every VA, including the Ann Arbor VA, and nursing students, you'll be on the wards eventually, has a seamless transition person whose job it is to make sure that these returning veterans get connected to the right services. So if you call Sarah Nowitzki at this number in Ann Arbor, and each VA has their own, her job and the people that she oversees will work with that person to get the kind of services that they need. Military OneSource. I want to mention this. One of the things that we have been learning is what reintegration services do service members gravitate to. So we have surveys, and we also have gone out on interviews. And over again, I hear that the one reintegration service that people actually use and like is Military OneSource. It's a website that you can go to, also a number, and they just cover a variety. It's basically, I think the National Guard folks we have talked to have voted with their feet. This is the one that they tend to use. There's also the Buddy to Buddy program, where if you really think that your veteran will only talk to another veteran or is really looking for someone to talk with, you can call this number and we'll match you up. I think there's one therapist here. I don't know if they're
I'm a nurse practitioner.
A nurse practitioner. In psychiatry, okay. There are also training for this. There are ways of getting yourself military ready if you haven't worked with a lot of veterans. And I would suggest that you know all the multiple resources, so load up on your way out. And maintain connections with these resources. Warm handoffs are really important. Don't just give people a piece of paper. If you can, call someone and let them know that your person is coming in. Nursing students, you might want to take the full list of papers. Here's what you can do if you want to train. And again, nursing students, you might want to take these. The online version is not that long. And you really just get a basic sense of what the military is like, what the problems are like, and I think it'll inform you as you run across these people in your daily work. There's also STAR Behavioral Health training that will be more intensive training on how to approach these folks. These are the programs that the University of Michigan has. There's a whole table outside. One is the Buddy-to-Buddy Volunteer Veteran Program. Another is for the students at U of M. There's the PAVE program, where upper-class people who have been in service will help entering class people engage. One of the things that actually increases dropout of schools is lack of social engagement, lack of social integration. It's huge in keeping people in school. And so we try to focus on that as well as help with academics. We also have child and family programs. For families, often the coming and going of a parent is a very difficult situation. The parent comes back changed. There's the reintegration, and this brings families together to talk about those transitions and has components for both the children and the family members. And also a program for military spouses called Homefront Strong. If people have their smartphones, there's a lot of applications now for people with PTSD. You can download this before you leave the library tonight, and it gives you basic information about the disorder, about where you can seek help, as well as some relaxation exercises and other information. It's free. There are a number of other apps that might be helpful. So three things to remember. It's what happens when they get back. Know just a couple of resources. When you come across your next friend, family member, you can connect them up easily at each VA. All you have to remember, actually, is each VA has some designated people that connect folks. They're big systems. People can go in. There can be some delays in treatment. They can get demoralized. Give them this one person, this one number. You can call the operator and say, you have a dedicated person for these folks. Who is he or she? And they will know who that person is. And get military one source. I'm going to make a hit for the Buddy to Buddy program. Our panels tonight are going to be Captain Nick Anderson and Ed Thomas. And I thought we would just have them come up and talk about their personal deployment experiences, just to let you get to know them a little bit, and then we'll take questions.
Hi, so I'm Captain Nick Anderson. I'm a full-time soldier with the Michigan Army National Guard. For my full-time job, I work for the Family Programs Division, so I help service members with all types of issues. I work with Jane and Dr. Valenstein on the Buddy-to-Buddy program. My military experience started in 2002, so you're like five then, I guess, or something like that. So now I feel really old. But I was 24, 25, and I was actually a stockbroker. I'd graduated from college already, and I was more or less bored with life. So I grew up in a military family. My dad was an Army officer, and I thought, what better way to get excitement than to join the National Guard? So I became an infantryman, and I was a traditional weekend warrior. So 1 week in a month, 2 weeks in the summer, go play in the woods, shoot guns, stuff like that. And I became an officer and did some more intensive training. And then 2007, I found out I was going to Iraq. So I deployed in Iraq, to Iraq in 2008. I was gone the whole year. And I was the executive officer of an infantry company. So out of 127 guys, I was second in command. A lot of responsibility, but I was an older guy. I think I turned 30 in Iraq. But I had a lot of younger kids, 18, 19-year-old kids who, just out of high school, you know, hadn't gone to college yet and sort of being big brother slash dad to them. And then I got back and didn't really want to go back to civilian work life, I guess. I liked the military and volunteered to go out to Afghanistan. So about 10 months later, trained up to go to Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan for all of 2010. While I was in Afghanistan, I was a combat advisor for Afghan infantry battalion. So me and 11 Americans, we had about 400 Afghans that we were responsible for. And very austere environment in Afghanistan, one of the worst. But it was the thing that, you know, Ed was active duty, I was National Guard, and Marcia talked about it, is that with both experiences, a large unit and then 11 guys, I think one of the hardest things I had to deal with when I got back was the separation. You know, I lived with my buddies for a year, you know, day in and day out. They saw the best and the worst of me. And then to come home and not be able to go to that central base, to go back to Fort Livingroom, as we call it, in lovely Flint, Michigan, when all my buddies were in different parts of the state, I think that was the hardest part. Also, not wanting to go back to the civilian workforce because, you know, people didn't understand me. I changed a little bit, but I wasn't as happy-go-lucky, free, and everybody will say that. I used to be the jokester, the life of the party, and now I'm very serious. You know, I don't do the whole joking thing, and everything's time, and, you know. So that's been my experience, and after I got back from Afghanistan, I started working for family programs and helping service members. And, you know, war does change people. It does. Slightly or a lot. It depends on the individual. You know, two soldiers, myself and another one of my really good soldiers, we went through exactly the same thing day after day after day. And I came back, I was fine. Yeah, I was irritable, sleep problems, you know, those four things. But I was fine. You know, one of my great soldiers, he tried to kill himself because he just couldn't deal with it anymore. You know, he didn't, for whatever reason, he didn't like what he did on deployment, or he just didn't like coming home. So one thing to keep in mind when you're dealing with veterans in the future is that don't always assume everybody is all messed up. Don't assume that everybody takes the same stressors the same way, because everybody is an individual and everybody processes stress in different levels. And always be open-minded when you're dealing with veterans. So that's my story. And then we'll take questions after Ed talks.
Really, in working with veterans or active duty soldiers or anything, it's really about the individual's experience. And the guy standing next to you, really, everybody comes from a different area of the world, area of the state, country. You know, a lot of our soldiers actually come from other countries and want to serve in our military to work towards citizenship. So it's something to always think about. It's always about the individual experience, as Nick stated. So that's definitely a good point. Myself, I currently work in the VA. I'm a clinical social worker, work in the PTSD clinical team, but also the military sexual trauma coordinator for the Ann Arbor VA. My military experience started back in 1995 when I enlisted in the Army. Served in as a combat medic and behavioral health tech from 95 to 99, and got out, went back to school. Actually went to Michigan State down the road here. Kind of woofing cheap clothing here in Michigan. Ann Arborville, but we'll work past that. I went back in 2006 as an officer, served until March 2014, so I just got back and came back to Michigan and working down here in the VA since then. During that time, I actually got married and have been married 18 years now. And during that time, we've been dual military the whole time that we were in. So she actually has two more years than I do. I went to grad school at University of Texas in Austin. And she was actually back in the military at that time, going through a doctorate in physical therapy program through the Army and Baylor University. We didn't have children, and then later in our careers, we decided to start having children, and that's how we ended up getting out. So there's a lot of different struggles that come on board. We talked about ages before, that demographic, looking at when do people start to have children, and how does that impact their life and their support systems and everything. So again, it all varies and it depends on the individual and what their support system looks like. So during my military service, I kind of had a very unique experience. I deployed to Bosnia when we went into Bosnia back in 96. I served over in Korea in an inpatient psychiatric unit for about 16 months, and then I decided to get out, and then I came back in at Fort Hood and deployed to Iraq 2008, 2009. I think we were kind of almost dovetailed on in country. Prior to my deployment to Iraq, my wife actually got deployed to Afghanistan in July. I went out and bought a nice set of golf clubs, thought I was going to get really good at golf. But then orders came down and I was actually shipped off to Iraq while she was deployed. And she was actually able to come and visit me over in Iraq. That was a good break for her. But we came back in 2009, both of us. She came back before I did, obviously, and then I came back to Fort Hood. And how many people remember what happened at Fort Hood around 2009? That was my first day back in clinic because I was a behavioral health officer then as well. So I ended up working a lot, very intimately with the individuals that were involved that day, a lot of the victims, the families, but then also you mentioned North Fort Hood where you did some of your train up. That's where a lot of the people that were there that day were actually stationed out at North Fort Hood going through their mobilization training that was talked about earlier, the different trainings that people go through at different times. So again, here's people that are National Guard and Reserve doing mobilization training at some place in Texas that may have come from Michigan or somewhere else. They're still in the United States. They're going through training, and then something like that happens. How does that impact them? And they got to still continue on downrange and deploy. They didn't even start the deployment yet. So thinking about how that actually could impact individuals. It was a very educational experience, to say the least. I'll say my experience in deployment when I was on deployment was very fast-paced, and that's something that you'll talk to a lot of different individuals about, that life happens fast, there's a lot of decisions to be made, and it's almost also that hurry up and wait mentality that maybe many people may have heard. When you deploy, you go, 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 mission after mission after mission, and my mission was actually providing behavioral health care downrange, so I actually had a pretty busy time. But when I got back, that mentality maintained because I was able to roll right into, I already had that mentality. I was working 20-hour days and doing a lot of different things, everything on those lines with that situation that occurred down there. But one of the things that as I transition off of active duty now, I'm still in the reserves. I'm a reserve unit down in Indianapolis I belong to. So I'm a captain in the reserves as a behavioral health officer. But the other part is really reaching out into the community and talking with veterans to actually break down those barriers and actually talk about, you know, these are situations that not everybody has experienced. As, you know, was talked about earlier, 2% of the population serves in the military. Break that down, and you're talking about, we were both in the military, we were both in Iraq at similar times, and yet our experiences are going to be completely different. Well, so is the guy standing right next to you. So those are different, there's no stigma really, because it, you don't know how it's going to impact you. And those, having that conversation with individuals helps to start break down those barriers to really look at, hey, we don't know how it's going to change you. And it's just that opportunity to have that conversation. So it's kind of my charge moving forward is to really continue to reach out into the community to with veterans, but also within the community and be a part of that community.
First question is prolonged exposure. And I mentioned that it can be hard for people. Is this on?
We can hear you anyway.
You can hear me anyway?
Yeah.
Okay. This one is? Okay. So, and do they do better if they have some support?
Is there just research to support that? Because it's an observation.
That they do better if they have...
That's my observation.
Yeah.
Some people drop out of... A lot of people drop out.
A lot of people do drop out.
And I'm in the CBOT where they television there. And, of course, I work with a team. They're a little younger than me. So they're very research-oriented, and anything I say is kind of poo-poo because it's not research. And I just, so I almost think it should be part of the screen support you have would be, I think, helpful because I have to pick up, I'm one of the few that, you know, there's three of us there, but right. I'm the provider, the prescriber.
So we're trying to do some research in this area, actually using some of the data from the Michigan National Guard. And we actually presented this today at noon at the VA, some of our data. And social support in a variety of ways, how many people are in your social network, how many, what is your perceived social support, what's your social support, your unit support like. We're all associated with whether you developed PTSD, whether you had PTSD symptoms and the severity of those symptoms. However, it wasn't associated with whether you went to get any treatment. So if it acts through whether you get treatment, social support would reduce your chance of having a disorder. That wouldn't mean that you would get treatment. We did not ask the question about treatment dropout. This was just, did you get anything? And a lot of people get something, but they don't actually finish a treatment because it's hard to stay in. Logistically hard to get to the appointments, but also prolonged exposure is a treatment that involves, I think, some level of discomfort as well. And I'm going to pass this on to Ed as he's part of our PCT team.
Absolutely. as was mentioned, I think social support going through, that's one of the things of going through PCT is getting them back and engaged in those relationships. And there is a level of uncomfortableness. And one of the conversations that you really begin with is getting comfortable with that uncomfortable and how that transitions. And a lot of times it's, you know, related to the experience that they may have had downrange and how that really, when they deployed, how that basically transposes onto all these different relationships when they return. So when you talk about the National Guard individual who actually has limited support or they're not around that unit anymore, as if they, in contrast to the active duty individual who is still within that network or within that community, which doesn't always hold true there either, but there's a certain level of support and camaraderie in that experience. So you're looking at support, the transition within the prolonged exposure is really looking at how do they interact with that memory, those thoughts, and that trauma element of it, but then also basically common day, everyday experiences that they're having, whether it be within individuals or be places, and what's going on in that, and the symptoms that they're experiencing, and breaking down those barriers, and getting them to be comfortable with that uncomfortable, obviously that's the goal in looking at the prolonged exposure therapy.
You know, I think that perhaps the families need to be warned this is going to be uncomfortable at parts, and sort of saying, oh my God, they're making you worse. Say, well, you need to be in there to have this exposure over and over again in order to handle this kind of
memory. You know, I met somebody today who had their prolonged exposure with a psychologist, and they were in a group and they went out as a group, which I thought really replicated probably more of a service kind of connection. And I often think with my clients who do not do well, who are avoidant, have left the treatment after like three sessions, I can't do this, I don't want to do it, they rarely leave the house. And what I have found for me, I used to be a public health nurse, and I'm older, and I am like a hands-on kind of person. And I kind of wish I could just take these three or four, you know, they don't fit into, I could take them to Myers and go shopping with them. And not on a crowded day, like at 8 a.m. when no one's in there, and then progress to 10 to 12.
Yeah, and that's something that, I mean, within the protocol itself, the way it's set up is they do a lot of that stuff. But, it, you know, even in the treatment itself, engaging in prolonged exposure therapy within the VA, there's a lot of different resources that we have as well. It was mentioned the peer-to-peer support. Well, we have the veteran-to-veteran support groups and stuff that are more kind of less outside of the therapy, you know, traditional therapy realm that actually provides that support. So they're talking to other veterans and getting that support as well and that engagement.
That would be very useful, I think, for my outliers. That's what I call them, outliers in my head, obviously. The people who aren't fitting in, who are spending way too much time at home, don't have a lot of social support.
And that is one of the good things about prolonged exposure, because yes, there's the element of the trauma related to the experience, but then we're also challenging the current day stuff, and the part of the in vivo is one of the elements, one of the tools within prolonged exposure. And that is really looking at current day stuff, the everyday experience, where they go to the grocery store and they can't tolerate the level of distress or something in that, really what's connected to that. And there's a processing of that experience and how that works within the individual and what's feeding that level of distress in the current everyday experience and how that relates back to that learned experience or that learned distress that they had downrange, and how does that come together and they kind of recalculate that experience to be more.
I just wish I had some magic that I could do for some clients who I just cannot get to that point.
Thank you for that question. The nursing students, we have a very practiced nurse up here. If you want to get a nursing perspective on treating these kinds of folks. Here's another question, and it's for Ed, but I think both Nick and Ed might have some ideas about this. And let's start with you, Nick, and then we'll go to Ed. What sort of sexual trauma cases occur during deployment, and how should a healthcare provider assess for this? How does the Michigan National Guard respond to cases of sexual trauma? And then we'll ask Ed how a health provider does.
So we have our sexual assault response coordinators, our SARCs, and how the military handles it, you have restricted and unrestricted reporting, and it deals in the investigation process and the anonymity of the individual. So a service member, one interesting fact is each year as many males are sexually assaulted as females, just as a percentage, because only 15 to 16% of the military are female. It's a higher percentage of the female. But on average, as many males are sexually assaulted as females per year in the military. And as you'd expect, most males are not are less willing to come forward when they are sexually assaulted. So unrestricted reporting and restricted. And like I said, each of them has their own quirks as to how the investigation goes, who knows, and as to what the punishment can be if that the person's found guilty, more or less. As far as cases go, when I was in Afghanistan coming home, 2 days before I was coming home, I was at a different FOB, forward operating base, that I normally is at. And after 9 o'clock, everybody had to have a battle buddy walking with them. I was an officer, generally in the Army or the military as an officer. Most rules don't apply to you because you're in charge. And so this young sergeant stopped me, and I almost got a ticket for not having a battle buddy. And I asked him why, and he said because 4 women had been raped within the week. For American service members, females, that didn't say who. You know, we had a lot of different countries on that FOB, locals, Afghans, but also the predominantly Americans. And it was pretty disheartening to hear that these females were embracing the suck, as we call it, with the rest of the guys, and doing more than their share of the hard work, and yet, and being taken advantage of and being sexually assaulted. And then, those are a lot of the cases you'll find. You also find, not a lot, but, prostitution rings, stuff like that, you find in the military. And those are very few and far between cases, but they do happen where a male soldier who has females in their unit with them, it works as the pimp, I guess you'd call him, and he gets his cut and she gets her cut of the money, whether she willingly does it or not, it's still a crime. It's definitely a crime. But those are the type of cases you'll find. You'll find rapes, you know, on both males and females. And it's really bad. And Ed probably has more with that, because as an infantry guy, when I was deployed at the time, we weren't allowed to have females with us. You know, it was all guys, which kind of makes it easier. But at the same time, we did have females on our FOB. We had like 3 out of 500 people. You know, 3 were females. And I'll let Ed talk in a second, but think about that. When you have 500 people, as a guy, it's easy. And that if I have to go somewhere and I have to have a battle buddy with me, if I don't like Joe, I can go to Ed or I can go to Bill. But if I'm Sally and I really don't like Ellen and Jane's okay, I have to instantly, no matter what, be a friend with one of those two, because no matter what, I always have to go with them somewhere. And another thing you need to think about is, you know, when you're amongst your fellow service members, you're supposed to feel safe. But a lot of times, if there's a threat of being raped or anything like that, when do you really feel safe? So that adds another level of stress to the female service member. They feel unsafe going outside the wear, but they also feel unsafe going to the latrine or going to the shower, going to the gym. Think about that, the mental of psychological effects coming home. And, you know, we talked about the hypervigilance and stuff like that. You know, if you never feel safe for a whole year, that's going to carry forward when you come home.
The different, I guess one of the things to think about is it's not just in deployments that this occurs, that there are cases within basic training. So you have somebody who wanted to join the military their whole life, first month into the military, and this happens to them where they're assaulted or all-out raped, and whether it be male or female, and how does that impact that individual? And then that individual then deploys and is downrange in an isolated circumstance, and how does that occur? On active duty, similar reporting, you know, restricted, unrestricted reports. And the whole idea behind that is to try and increase the level of people getting into care and treatment. So restricted would mean that it wouldn't go to law enforcement, but you'd open up the channels to the medical care and everything that would be able to be available to you. Unrestricted means that everybody from the commander to the law enforcement and the medical care would be engaged at that time, and they would actually pursue to actually follow up on legal charges and stuff on those lines. Downrange, it ran the gamut from assaults to attempts to actual rapes. And there's cases where those rapes resulted in the individual committing suicide. Again, looking at the violation that occurred of this core unit that was supposed to be there, and we're of the same creed. We're in the military, we're supposed to be taking care of each other, and this got, I was violated on that level. It's a little different than combat trauma. When you look at combat trauma, you're going in as a unit and you experience combat. This is an attack against the individual. So you look at what's going on. And sometimes when you look at assaults on females versus assaults on male, there could be, you know, is it an individual perpetrator or are there multiple perpetrators? And does that change the dynamic? So you really run the gamut on what's going on. And, you know, we can focus in on, say, that, you know, sexual assault and sexual trauma is a problem within the military, but I think we're hearing about it a lot more in just everyday our communities, our athletic teams, and everything that's going on in professional groups. It just, again, is something that's occurring. It should not be occurring. But one of the things that, you know, Nick talked about is really looking at the buddy-to-buddy system, having those battle buddies that go with you everywhere, and watch out as a provider, as a mental health provider or a medical provider, is following up on those. When did this behavior start? When did this change in your personality or change in your hypervigilance? When did that happen? Asking those, kind of looking for a timeline. And asking that question, is there anything significant that happened around this time? And that's a little different than, have you ever been raped? So having that kind of coming around the corner in asking a question, as opposed to being very blunt and forward with it, allows you to actually get the individual talking and really to find out how best to help them. Because this is something that they may not even associate with when X, Y, and Z symptom may have begun. And just by having that conversation can actually be a moment that they actually put it together and actually can actually really bring about some resolution to that symptom, to say, wow, I'm not just experiencing these symptoms because of no reason. There's actually a point that this did occur. Does that kind of help answer that question?
We have a question from each one of you from another person in the audience. Ed, they're asking, can you talk more about the struggles of having kids and being in the military? And I happen to know that Captain Anderson also has kids. So maybe briefly, each of your perspectives on what it's like to have children and be in the military.
Absolutely. It's kind of, we were talking just before, Nick and I were talking, part of my decision, my wife and my decisions to get out of the military was because we started to have children. We got back in 2009, we had our first in 2010, second in 2011, and then the third in 2013. So I have a 4, 2, and 1-year-old. And I was actually on active duty and enrolled in the Army Baylor, or the Army Physical Therapy, or Physician Assistant Program. And we found out we got pregnant with the third, and we were like, we're done. So it's a struggle. It's something that you really need to pay attention to. My wife and I had tried to think about any of our friends or acquaintances, second, third degree acquaintances that had more than one child and was dual military, and we couldn't come up with a single one.
And is the concern that you're both going to be deployed at the same time?
There's an element of both being deployed at the same time. There's an element of, as you increase in rank, your job becomes, you know, from a 40-hour week to a 50 to a 60 to a 60 to a 70-hour work week, where the children are in daycare from 6 o'clock in the morning until, because you got to go to physical training, exercise with the troops and everything on those lines. And it's just a struggle. It's a constant struggle. And for the young individuals who are at an installation there, who may be not dual military, but may be single and have children, the pull's on that. And when the child care center says, well, we close at 6 o'clock, but the unit says you got to clean the meal vans until 7, how do you manage that? And the stressors. So there's a tremendous amount of stress, everyday stress.
I think we have a veteran in the audience who wants to comment on that.
Sure, I just wanted to say my husband and I are both active duty Air Force. We both retired from the Air Force, and here are two of our 6 children that we raised. I don't know if they want to comment on that or not, but the daycare situation was certainly always a challenge. I put my husband on the airplane when he went to Desert Storm, and then went on to work quite long shifts and having to get the kids from daycare, so having children in the military, I think my children would tell you that it was very interesting and a very interesting way of life, but it certainly had its challenges, and I'll put them on the spot, and I'm sure they'd be happy to answer any question if anybody wanted to talk to them about it, but it certainly was, it was a good life, but it was full of challenges, if that helps.
Nick, do you want to say anything about it?
Yeah, so, I'm a National Guard person, not to take anything away from your kids, but I think my kids had it harder because on a base, all the kids go through it. My kids, none of their friends had to go through what they had to go through. None of their dads or moms were deployed. My daughter was 3.5 when I got back from Afghanistan. Out of those 3.5 years, I was gone 2 of them. My son was 2 when I got home. I was gone for the second year of his life. We didn't have that social support of the base. My dad was in Vietnam. You know, I grew up in an Army family, so my dad, my mom, they got it. You know, my brother, kinda. He never served in the military, but my parents were really good. But as far as our friends, you know, I was the only military person. And my kids were this big, so it's not like they were in high school and they were going through all that stuff with boys and all that crap. But still, it was different. You know, I talked to my daughter and son when I was in Afghanistan on Skype, and, you know, for the first 2 months of me getting home, they still thought I lived in the laptop. You know, and my son, I'd be sitting in the living room and my son would be like, you know, daddy, daddy, in the laptop. And I'm like, hey, I'm right here type thing. And they never really understood where I went. You know, they always saw pictures of Iraq and the sandstorms and stuff like that. But, you know, my daughter always said that I worked at the airport because for the first 3 years of her life, she was taking me to the airport all the time, either to go to training or to go overseas. So that's hard. You know, now they're 7 and 6, and they don't really talk about it. You know, they were so young. But from an active duty side, it's kind of nice that all the kids sort of go through the same thing, you know, because in the active duty, you deploy big units from a base, either a wing in the air or a battalion or a brigade in the Army, and pretty much everybody goes through the same thing, you know. You know, Johnny's dad's deployed, so is mine. So I have that peer support. I know what they're going through. But with reserve component kids, they don't have that. And a lot of times, school systems, they don't even know that the kid's parent is deployed until there's behavioral issues. You know, and this kid was a star student. And then all of a sudden, she's acting out. And why is that? Well, we didn't know that, you know, her dad or her mom was deployed. And, you know, she's a teenager and, you know, she's going through a lot of stuff. And now one of those parents is gone, you know. So that's one thing that we do with our youth programs is educating schools, especially when we have large deployments of, hey, this is what could happen. Not saying it's going to.
One of the other things on one of my roles when I was on active duty was working with family advocacy, so a lot of domestic violence, child neglect and stuff on those lines. And some of the stuff that would happen in that realm was we'd be downrange and somebody would be getting a call from their spouse back home to discipline their child over Skype.
Yeah, okay.
And or call the plumber and figure out how to fix something at the house. So this guy's getting ready to go out on mission or a girl's getting ready to go out on mission and they're having to solve these problems and resolve these issues back at home. In that respect, that's one element of it. But one of the other things I always like to point out is the one in uniform in some way has it easier because we're going to do something new. We're going somewhere. You get to stay home. You get to pick up all the things that I was doing. And you don't get, you're just going to do more of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's different. So when you come back and you redeploy back into that, those roles, really figuring out how that works. This individual that stayed home has been doing it by themselves for the past year or 15 months, however long it might be. How do you reinsert into that? So within the family dynamic, how does that work with the children? Who's the disciplinarian and everything on those lines? Because, you know, especially, you know, dad comes in, he wants to be the one that this is the way it goes. Well, mom's been doing it by herself for that period of time. How does that work? So there's communication, communication, communication.
So I hope our gentleman will stick around to answer any personal questions that you have. There were two more questions that came up. I'll just answer them very briefly because we're about ready to end. One is there any stigma around seeking mental health care among veterans? Yes, there's a lot of it. And what is being done to reduce that? I would say that we've been making lots of efforts with the Michigan National Guard. The Army's made lots of efforts nationally. We were able to actually to show with data over the space of 2007 to 2012 a decline in stigma among the Michigan National Guard. Through lots of efforts, like Nick's with his systems of care, through leadership, and so it can be addressed. It is there. It's possible to bring it down. Yeah.
One thing with stigma also is University of Michigan held an MSPAN held a mental health summit, a national mental health summit in April of 2013, and we had or they, excuse me, I say we because we're a team. Sergeant Major of the Army Ray Chandler. So Sergeant Major of the Army Ray Chandler is the top enlisted advisor. So in the military, you have officers and you have enlisted. And this guy he's the top dog, more or less, of the enlisted corps. And he spoke very frankly about his deployment experience and him seeking mental health. And the overall message of that was that here this guy is the top of the food chain, and he talked about the issues he had and that he sought mental health, and that if he can seek mental health, keep his security clearance, keep his job, and keep the respect of, you know, the men of the Army, that if he can do it, anybody can do it. And I think that he's conveyed that message so well over the last couple of years that that's one of the issues or reasons that the stigma is going away is that you see leadership that is not afraid to admit that, hey, you know, sometimes you have to take a knee and go talk about your issues, and it's okay that your worker bees, your lower enlisted, will do the same thing.
These are brave men. Think about talking about
and women.
And women. These are brave men and women. And think about talking about if you have mental health issues, frankly, with people that you don't know. It's kind of brave. The last one was, have VA providers thought of doing peer-to-peer groups in homes of veterans? I don't think we have done that yet. We do have telemental health that's going into the home so that it's very convenient for people, but we have not yet gone to do groups in homes. There are groups that are going on in vet centers, informal places. Do you know of any groups in homes?
Not in the homes, just the telehealth that we can do into the home
for
individual work.
The Vietnam-era veterans did make it a point that sometimes veterans need to get together in places that are not medical centers to talk about issues, and that those kind of vet centers have continued, which are informal places. Thank you guys all so much again for braving the cold, for being nursing students, for being veterans, for being community members who care. Thanks so much.